Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take complex, often dense source material and break it down into the insights you really need to be well-informed.
And today we are taking on a challenge that goes right to the, to the core operating system of government accountability.
It really does. We are diving into a detailed legal argument that doesn't just critique public policy.
Yeah.
It actually questions the very legitimacy of government immunity doctrines themselves.
Yeah, this idea that certain officials or even the state can't be held civilly or, you know, criminally responsible for their wrongs.
Exactly. And according to our source material today, this isn't just bad law. It's presented as an outright constitutional fraud.
It is perhaps the most profound claim we've ever unpacked here.
I think it might be.
The article we're dissecting, it's titled Immunity, the Undelegated Fraud, Why Government Cannot Lawfully Exempt Itself from Accountability. And it approaches this from a perspective of strict constructionism.
Which means it goes all the way back.
All the way back to the law of nature to make its case. So our mission today is to really extract the core arguments that governmental immunity is a fundamental constitutional overreach, a structural injury.
Why? What's the reason?
Because it violates the pre-existing, non-negotiable rights that government was created solely to secure and defend.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately, because that central premise is a powerful hook. The author states, just flatly, that immunity is not law. It's a usurpation of the people's sovereignty.
Right.
And the reason is because the people, who are the ultimate sovereign, never actually delegated the power to the government to be unaccountable.
It was withheld.
That power was withheld.
Okay.
So if the government claims that power anyway, it's operating on an assumed, not a delegated authority.
That's the core charge we are starting with.
And it requires us, and you listening, to rethink the entire legal foundation of the state.
Precisely. And this is why the author starts not with, say, the U.S. Constitution or the Bill of Rights.
Which is where you'd expect them to start.
It is. But they start with what they argue is the true source of all legitimate authority, an authority which precedes and dictates the bounds of the Constitution itself.
And this brings us to a concept you were mentioning before we started.
Yes, what I like to call the firewall, this immutable hierarchy of law that no human institution, no matter how powerful or ancient, can lawfully breach.
And immunity, in this view.
Immunity, according to this forensic analysis, is a catastrophic breach of that firewall. So we really have to trace the argument from its absolute start to fully grasp its conclusion.
And I think that step is crucial for anyone trying to learn this, because most of us operate under the assumption that the Constitution is the highest law.
That's the common understanding.
But here, we're being asked to look at the law that informed the Constitution. So let's begin before statutes, before courts, before even the Declaration of Independence.
We have to. We begin with the foundational premise that law precedes the state. The sources refer to this as the laws of nature and of nature's God.
Which is the very concept, right out of the Declaration, that entitled Americans to form a separate nation in the first place.
It's the entire basis for their claim of right. This pre-legal foundation establishes the fixed boundaries of government before government is even organized.
If you miss this step,
you fail to understand the limitation of delegated power. It's that simple. And the most accessible articulation of this comes from William Blackstone. The source quotes him affirming that natural law is coeval with mankind and dictated by God himself.
And that's critical. When Blackstone wrote this, he was placing a limit on parliamentary supremacy, arguing there were things even the king and parliament could not lawfully do.
Exactly. He called this law superior in obligation, binding everywhere. And here is the key, the immutable constraint. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this.
Think about the implications of that for every statute, every regulation, every court ruling today.
It's massive. This doctrine means every act of government is automatically void if it contradicts natural justice, regardless of legislative procedure. It's a very high and enduring bar.
That immediately challenges any doctrine of absolute legal positivism. You know, the idea that law is simply whatever the authorized body says it is.
It rejects it completely. Instead, we have a fixed external standard, and this is reinforced by a powerful legal maxim.
Okay.
Jus naturale est quod apud omnes homines eandem habet potentiam.
And for us, that means?
Translated. Natural law has the same force among all men.
So it's universal.
It is. So if this natural law is supreme and it applies equally to all people, how can an institution created by men, the government, claim to be exempt from it? It cannot. And this leads us directly to the definition of pre-state, pre-political rights. The source material really emphasizes that these rights are not gifts.
Right, they're not from the government.
Not at all. Thomas Paine, in Rights of Man, he stressed that rights are not grants from one man to another. Their origin is solely in the nature of man. They are inherent endowments, like breathing or the need for self-defense.
They exist prior to any social compact.
Right. And this is where the strict legal definition meets political philosophy. Frederick Basquiat drives this point home in the law. He observes that life, liberty, and property existed before men made laws.
That's a foundational premise of classical liberalism, isn't it? Government didn't create these rights.
Government was created by men because these pre-existing rights required defense.
And that's a crucial distinction. If you believe the state grants rights, then you accept the state can take them away.
But if you believe they are natural endowments, the state can only defend them. That's the critical pivot. Since every individual possesses the natural right to defend their life, liberty, and property,
then it's logical.
It's logical that men combine that defensive authority to form a collective organization for defense, which is the government.
And this, and only this, is the sole legitimate justification for its existence.
Right. So if you, as an individual, cannot lawfully violate my rights, you can't steal my property or arbitrarily jail me,
then the collective force, which is just a substitute for our individual defensive rights, can't lawfully violate my rights either.
Precisely. The government is simply the sum of our individual rights to self-defense, nothing more. Bastiat states that the collective force, the government, cannot rationally have any other end or any other mission than that of the isolated forces for which it is substituted.
So the conclusion is, it's unavoidable. Government's sole legitimate purpose is to secure rights, not to destroy or infringe upon them. It is strictly a defensive agency.
And this is distilled into a controlling axiom. Law is the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense.
Which means, if we accept this, then the moment the government assumes other functions, the moment it acts offensively or takes on powers beyond defense,
it is acting outside its original charge and mandate. It moves from securing rights to infringing them.
And this brings us to the necessary consequence of that overreach, usurpation.
Exactly. The source uses the Alabama Constitution, Article 1, Section 35, as codified proof that this wasn't just some philosophical theory, but a founding principle intended to be hard law.
What does it say?
It explicitly states that the sole object and only legitimate end of government is to protect the citizen in the enjoyment of life, liberty, and property, and when the government assumes other functions, it is usurpation and oppression.
Usurpation and oppression. That language shows the gravity with which the founders viewed governmental function creep.
It ties directly back to Thomas Jefferson's stark warning that the two enemies of the people are criminals and government, and that we must tie the second down with the chains of the Constitution.
So the Constitution, in this view, is purely a restraint on the government, the agent.
That's exactly how Thomas M. Cooley framed it in his seminal 1868 work, Constitutional Limitations. Cooley stressed that the Constitution grants no rights to the people because those rights are pre-existing and inherent.
The Constitution is merely the instrument of their convenience.
And, crucially, a limitation upon the powers of government in the hands of agents. The agent is given defined, limited powers, and the document is meant to restrain that agent.
So the government is simply an agent, and the Constitution is the chain meant to keep that agent in check. That perspective shifts the entire way we look at governmental power from a default of power.
To a default of no power. It means our first question must always be, where is the specific delegated grant of power for this action?
And that question leads us directly to the concept you mentioned earlier, the unbreakable hierarchy, the firewall.
Right. The author argues that all legitimate governmental action must conform to this structure, from the highest philosophical principle down to the lowest regulation.
And if an act violates a higher level,
the act is void from its inception.
And here we bring in a foundational legal maxim that seems to govern this whole discussion. Quod ab initio non valet. Intractu temporis non convalescit.
What is void from the beginning does not become valid with time.
I have to ask, though, as an intermediary for you, the listener, This is a very strict idea. Wouldn't decades of legal precedent, scare decisis, wouldn't that override such an ancient maxim? Surely, time must heal a political wound, even if it started as a fraud.
Well, that is the core conflict between the source material's strict construction and modern legal realism. And the source material argues emphatically, no,
No.
No. If a doctrine like broad immunity was born illegitimate because the power to create it was never delegated, then the passage of time only compounds the usurpation. It doesn't legitimize it.
So the fraud remains a fraud.
Exactly. This maxim is the death knell for any unlawful act, no matter how long it has been practiced or how many courts have affirmed it.
That makes the structure of the firewall immensely important. Let's walk through the four non-negotiable levels of this hierarchy.
Okay, at the apex, we have the law of revelation and divine law. It is supreme and unchangeable. As Blackstone noted, no human institution has the authority to amend or suspend it.
That provides the ultimate moral and philosophical boundary.
Then, second, come the fundamental maxims of law. These are self-evident, eternal rules that clarify and enforce that divine law.
And a huge influence on the founders here was Lord Coke.
Yes, Coke defined these in his institutes as propositions to be of all men confessed and granted without proof, argument, or discourse. He was saying these are legal axioms that define the limits of human authority itself.
They are not to be disputed.
Not to be disputed. Then, subordinate to those maxims, we find the constitutions.
These documents, like the U.S. Constitution?
They're restraints upon government, and their authority is conditional. They must conform to the higher law. As Cooley stressed again, no enactment can rise above the Constitution, but the Constitution itself must bow to the higher law.
And finally, at the lowest level, you have the day-to-day stuff.
Enactments, statutes, codes, and rules, the conditional expressions of legislative will. They are not the law of the land in themselves, but merely conditional instructions to the agent.
Subject always to the Constitutions, the maxims, and reason above them.
This rigid structure explains why a violation is so grave. If a statute violates the Constitution, it falls. But if the Constitution is interpreted in a way that violates a fundamental maxim or natural law,
as the author argues immunity does,
then the interpretation of the Constitution and all laws stemming from it is null and void.
The source material underlines this gravity by citing Imre Vattel's The Law of Nations,
a key text for the founders, so foundational that Congress was delegated power to punish offenses against it.
And Vattel called the violation of laws by those invested with authority a capital crime against society.
A perfidious abuse of the power with which they are entrusted. It suggests that officials violating the constitutional structure are committing the gravest offenses possible.
So now we shift to the immutable rules of delegation.
Yes. Since the people are the sole source of legitimate authority, government power is a trust conferred by delegation. If you're going to claim a power like immunity, you must find the explicit delegation for it.
But wait, doesn't modern legal theory rely heavily on the idea of implied powers?
It does.
Especially for the executive branch to function efficiently. The argument is often that you don't need to write down every single specific power if the general grant requires it. How does this strict constructionist view handle that?
That is precisely the point of contention the source material refutes. James Madison defined the relationship in Federalist No. 45 to preclude such a broad interpretation.
What did he say?
He said, "The powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined. What is not granted is withheld. This establishes what they call the constitution of exclusion. There is no open-ended grant of power."
So the absolute constraint laid out by Thomas Paine is defining. Power is either delegated,
a legitimate trust traceable to the people's charter,
or assumed
usurpation. There are no other lawful sources.
And this requirement is codified in the 10th Amendment. Powers not delegated are reserved to the states or to the people.
Therefore, there is no presumption of governmental authority, no concept of implied consent for major structural shifts like unaccountability, and certainly no constructive grant.
The burden of proof is always on the government agent to cite the specific grant.
Always. Which means, if we apply this rule to immunity, the rule governing immunity must be that the claim of immunity must itself be expressly delegated to be lawful.
And if it isn't?
It must be rejected. Immunity is the removal of accountability, and accountability is the absolute, non-negotiable condition of delegated authority. Any government branch that asserts immunity absent that express constitutional warrant is acting against the sovereignty of the people.
And is, by definition, usurpation. And because it violates the fundamental terms of the trust, it cannot be ratified or fixed later. It remains void ab initio.
Let's look at the principle of exclusion now. The author argues that the failure to grant sweeping immunity to all officials wasn't an oversight.
It was intentional, a calculated political choice by the sovereign people. And the evidence they use for this is, frankly, brilliant.
It's the highest form of evidence, self-evident proof of capacity. The people proved they had the power to grant immunity by exercising it once, and only once, in the Constitution itself.
In Article 1, Section 6, the Speech or Debate Clause.
Exactly. That clause grants a very narrow parliamentary privilege. Representatives and senators shall not be questioned in any other place for any speech or debate in either house.
That is a deliberate, expressly written grant of specific, limited immunity for a legislative function.
And that single, deliberate exception proves two critical things. First, the framers and the people knew precisely how to write a grant of immunity into the Charter.
And second,
their failure to grant it to executive officers, judges, or prosecutors is conclusive proof they intended to reserve accountability for those roles.
So the legal concept here is casus omissus pro omisso habendus est.
What is omitted is excluded.
If the founders had wanted absolute judicial immunity, they would have written, judges shall not be questioned in any other place for any opinion rendered in any court.
But they didn't. The silence of the Constitution regarding broad immunity for all other officials is, in this view, the loudest denial possible.
This leads us directly to the fiduciary trust model. The system is not a monarchy, but a trust.
And officers are trustees. They are not masters. Claiming an undelegated power, especially one as fundamental as freedom from consequences, is an immediate, unforgivable breach of that trust.
This analysis sounds like it was lifted directly from John Locke.
Which is no accident, given his influence. Locke, in the Second Treatise of Government, laid out the consequences when the legislative transgresses the fundamental rule and tries to grasp absolute power.
What did he say?
He wrote that, by this breach of trust, they forfeit the power the people had put into their hands.
So this analysis sees modern immunity doctrines, especially those created by judges,
as precisely that grasping of power that dissolves the contract.
And Locke presented the foundational choice that immunity, by its very nature, answers incorrectly.
He did. He asked the public to consider whether it is better for the people to be always exposed to the boundless will of tyranny, or for rulers to be sometimes liable to be opposed when they grow exorbitant in the use of their power.
And immunity chooses tyranny. It opts to shield the ruler at the expense of the injured citizen and the rule of law itself.
The core charge remains. The people never consented to broad immunity. Any act shielding officials from the consequences of violating rights, the very rights the government was hired to secure, is void ab initio.
The moment the agent claims a power, the principle explicitly reserved, the trust is dissolved.
In that aspect, the government ceases to be legitimate.
So now we move to the direct assault on accountability. The sources argue that accountability is not an optional feature of government. It is the defining structural condition of delegated authority.
And this brings up that famous common law maxim, ubi jus, ibi remedium.
Where there is a right, there must be a remedy.
Right. And immunity breaches the delegation by erecting structural barriers that sever the relationship between the people and their agents by denying the remedy.
And what's fascinating is that this principle isn't just implied from maxims. It is explicit in historical state constitutional texts that inform the federal system.
It is. Take the Massachusetts Constitution, Part the First, Article V. It affirms that all officers are at all times accountable to the people.
At all times accountable.
Article 8 reinforces this by securing the people's right to require an exact and constant observance of the laws. That phrase, at all times accountable, is an absolute rejection of judicial or executive immunity. It makes accountability continuous, non-conditional, and inescapable.
And the Maryland Declaration of Rights is just as clear.
Article 6, it's equally definitive. All persons entrusted with power are the trustees of the public and, as such, accountable for their conduct.
You simply cannot be an accountable trustee and simultaneously enjoy immunity from the consequences of breaching that trust.
They are, by their very definitions, mutually exclusive concepts.
And yet, despite these explicit mandates, we have the modern phenomenon of structural insulation, the creation of opaque bureaucracies.
We see commissions, councils, boards, administrative tribunals interposed between the people and their agents. The source describes it as a structural subversion of these accountability mandates.
They don't exist to ensure due process.
No, they function to nullify direct liability by diverting complaints into institutional black holes, ensuring the officer is rarely, if ever, directly answerable to the sovereign people in a court of law.
And the ultimate consequence is what the founders feared. Tyranny.
Which the source defines not necessarily as a violent coup, but as a condition. Where the people are prevented from enforcing the law against their own agents, Government elevates itself above the law.
The rule of law is extinguished, and lawful government ceases to exist.
Now, to fully understand the extent of this subversion, we have to look back at the common law tradition which the founders inherited. Historically, the foundation of justice inherently rejected this idea.
Let's start with the sheriff analogy, which really grounds the concept in reality.
Yeah.
The sheriff was the paradigm of the people's officer.
Right. Charged with enforcing law and maintaining peace. But at common law, sheriffs were never immune. If a sheriff committed a wrong seizing property without cause using excessive force, he was sued instantly in his individual capacity.
That principle ensured law enforcement was tethered to the rule of law, not elevated above it.
And it's rooted in maxims of strict trust law. Fiducia est stricti juris, a trust is of strict right. And absolutely critically, commodum ex injuria sua nemo habere debet.
No one may profit from his own wrong.
Right. An officer who commits a wrong and then profits by escaping the consequence of that action is doing something the common law explicitly forbade. Immunity is, in this light, profit from wrong.
But the source material identifies the most important structural injury that allowed modern immunity to flourish, the subjugation of the jury's authority.
That's right. The jury was the people's ultimate guardian of accountability. Historically, juries were universally understood to be judges of both fact and law.
Not just fact.
Both. This power was intentionally vested in the people to ensure that no government agent, no officer, no prosecutor, no judge could be the final arbiter of his own authority.
It was the living, breathing application of the maxim nemo judex in causa sua.
No one may be judge in his own cause. If a judge or an official claimed a power was lawful, the people's jury had the constitutional authority to disagree and strike down the claim in that specific case.
I see the crucial link now. If the judiciary is the primary beneficiary of immunity, and the jury is the only body designed to judge the lawfulness of the judiciary's actions, then dismantling the jury's power is a precondition for immunity to exist.
Precisely. By confining juries purely to fact-finding and reserving all questions of law to the bench, the judiciary systematically neutralized the people's final constitutional check.
The judges who benefit from immunity gain the exclusive power to define the law.
And they use that power to define it in a way that shields their own class.
This process of class-based privilege is fundamentally rejected by historical pillars of justice, going all the way back to Magna Carta.
To no one will we sell, to no one deny, to no one delay justice or right. It admits absolutely no exception based on office or rank.
And both Sir Edward Coke and William Blackstone affirmed this in their commentaries.
That every man is accountable for his own wrongs, with no exemption carved out for public officials just because they wear a badge or hold a title. Law was supposed to be blind to status.
Vattel provided the philosophical ultimate boundary when he said, "The sovereign can make no law which shall destroy that end."
Meaning the preservation of rights. A legal doctrine that extinguishes accountability for rights violations destroys the purpose of the law itself.
And that leads to the final, stark conclusion of this section.
If the reason for the law ceases, the law itself ceases. Cessante ratione legis, cessat ipsa lex. If the reason for government is to ensure accountability and secure rights, and immunity destroys accountability.
And immunity destroys lawful government.
And the ultimate outcome is defined by the final maxim. Ubi lex non est, ibi tyrannis. Where the law is not, there is tyranny.
So now we transition from the philosophical foundation to the practical mechanisms of the fraud itself. The core argument here is that modern immunity doctrines are not law born from legitimate delegation.
They are the result of officials acting outside delegated authority to shield themselves and their colleagues. This is unilateral self-grant, which is the definition of usurpation.
And the author specifically calls out the judiciary's role as uniquely destructive.
Because they are constructing doctrines from which they directly benefit. They're acting as suitors in their own cause, which is an explicit violation of nemo judex in causa sua. This self-dealing is why the fraud is so effective and so difficult to dislodge.
Let's start with statutory evasion. We often point to Title 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 as the civil rights law that allows citizens to sue officials for rights violations.
But the author contends that Congress was never granted the power to suspend accountability in the first place. Therefore, the statute's use as a vehicle for creating immunity doctrine, rather than just defining the process of accountability, is an assumption of undelegated authority.
That's a powerful challenge to congressional authority, isn't it? It invokes the maxim delegatus non potest delego.
A delegate cannot delegate. Congress is a delegate of the people. The people delegated to Congress the power to legislate, not the power to extinguish the people's fundamental right to hold their agents accountable. Congress cannot transfer away the people's retained sovereignty.
And the source applies the same structural flaw to other statutory immunizations, like the 1986 law that immunized vaccine manufacturers from certain liability.
The argument is the same. Congress possesses no enumerated power to extinguish liability for injury caused by any private or public actor. The authority to destroy remedies for violated rights was never delegated to the legislature, and thus its exercise is void.
It's quod ab initio non valet all over again.
Exactly. Beyond statutes, we see the creation of what the source calls administrative weapons used for shielding. Things like judicial councils or internal review boards.
These bodies are erected to interpose institutional defenses between the people and the judiciary, ensuring that judges are rarely, if ever, directly answerable.
They function to divert and foreclose redress, effectively neutralizing the legal remedy. And that brings us back to the maxims of agency.
Quod per me non possum, nec per alium.
What I cannot do myself, I cannot do through another. If a judge or Congress cannot lawfully immunize themselves directly, they cannot create an administrative body or council to achieve the same result indirectly.
And this systemic subversion also extends to the neutralization of the grand jury.
Historically, the grand jury served as the people's tribunal. It held power to initiate proceedings against public officials, even judges and governors.
But today, prosecutors have assumed exclusive control over the charging process,
which strips the grand jury of its power to act independently. This ensures the people's direct accountability mechanism can never reach those who wield state power. The author argues this isn't just a procedural change, but a mechanism of fraud.
Fraus et justum quam cohabitant fraud and law never dwell together.
Now, for the clearest illustration, judicial self-dealing. We must reiterate that judicial immunity is the clearest instance of self-dealing possible. Judges benefit from the very doctrines they interpret, apply, and expand.
It's an incurable conflict, violating nemo debet esse judex in propria causa.
No one ought to be judge in his own cause.
I understand the maxim, but I have to play devil's advocate here. Conventional legal thinking says judges need some degree of immunity. Otherwise, they could be endlessly harassed by disgruntled litigants, which would impede their independence and paralyze the system. How does the source material dismantle that rationale?
It dismantles it by referring back to the original common law design and the constitutional structure. The rationale of institutional convenience is subordinate to the fundamental maxim, ubi usi remedium.
A right must have a remedy.
So if the institutional need for independence requires the wholesale denial of remedies for citizens whose rights were destroyed by a judge's malicious or ultra vires act, then the institution is claiming a power tyranny that the people never delegated.
The system was designed to protect the people from the judge, not the judge from the people.
The conflict of interest is paramount. And this conflict explains the systematic subjugation of the jury, which was the people's check on that very judicial power.
Exactly. The jury was the people's tribunal, empowered historically to judge both fact and law.
And Chief Justice Jay recognized this historical right in the landmark case of Georgia v. Brailsford in 1794. He instructed jurors that they have a right to take upon yourselves to judge of both, and to determine the law as well as the fact.
The jury decided whether the judge's instruction was constitutional.
But the modern usurpation is ubiquitous. In almost every court in the country, judges instruct the jury, you must follow the law as I explain it.
And that instruction converts the jury from a constitutional check, a final bulwark of the people's sovereignty, into a mechanical instrument of the bench.
It is a direct claim of usurped power, violating a verbis legis non est recedendum. From the words of the law, there is no receding. The judge is reciting a procedural rule that directly contradicts the historical power of the jury.
And the source material highlights that this isn't subtle. It's openly codified in state procedural guides.
The Texas Uniform Jury Handbook from 2023, for example, openly instructs jurors that their verdict must be based solely on the rules of law provided by the judge. This is the express administrative abolition of the Georgia v. Brailsford doctrine.
By consolidating the power to define the law exclusively in the bench and stripping the jury, the judiciary ensures that the one independent body designed to scrutinize immunity, the people themselves, cannot function.
Immunity survives because the institution that benefits from the fraud dismantled the specific mechanism designed to stop it.
Which brings us to the sovereign immunity paradox. Let's tackle the linguistic fraud inherent in that very term.
Right, because the claim itself rests on a deliberate inversion of political reality. sustained by manipulating language to obscure the true constitutional location of sovereignty.
Language is weaponized here.
Absolutely. Government agents and legal scholars often deploy the term sovereign citizen as a pejorative, a rhetorical tool used to conflate legitimate assertions of popular sovereignty with fringe theories about law.
This poisoning of the well prevents substantive discussion about where true sovereignty really lies in the American system.
But the constitutional fact, according to Thomas M. Cooley, is non-negotiable. The state is but another name for the people collectively. The sovereignty resides in the people, not in any office.
If the people are the sovereign, then government is merely the agent, the servant.
And the central paradox is revealed here. The agent cannot logically possess sovereign immunity over the principal. This would fundamentally reverse the chain of authority, placing the servant above the master.
It violates the maxima nemo potest plus juris ad alium transfer quam ipse abet.
No one can transfer to another a greater right than he himself possesses. The people never possessed the right to be unaccountable to natural law, nor did they delegate that non-existent right to their agents.
So we resolve the paradox with simple logic. If the state means the people collectively, as Cooley suggests, then sovereign immunity is immunity of the people from themselves.
Which is an obvious absurdity.
And conversely, if government officials claim it, as judges, prosecutors, and executives do, then sovereignty has been unlawfully relocated from the people to their servants.
A relocation that lacks any constitutional warrant and is, therefore, usurpation.
So this is confirmed by those early state constitutions we discussed, like the Massachusetts Constitution, Articles 2 and V. They state all power resides in the people, and magistrates are substitutes and agents at all times accountable to them.
Accountability and sovereignty in the American context are structurally and legally inseparable.
The resulting deception is dual, then. Immunity falsely implies inherent governmental sovereignty, allowing the creature to claim the mantle of the creator.
And simultaneously, it stigmatizes citizens who insist on constitutional accountability, neutralizing resistance. The source calls this domination through misdefinition.
And they cite another strong maxim, verba chartarum fortius excipiuntur contra proferendum.
The words of an instrument are construed most strongly against the one who asserts them. Since the government is asserting the claim of immunity against the people, the ultimate sovereign, that claim must be scrutinized most stringently against the government.
Which is the exact opposite of what modern courts do.
The inescapable conclusion is that the people never delegated this immunity. A government that asserts it against its own sovereign commits usurpation by definition.
It is a power that was retained by the principal and unlawfully seized by the agent, rendering the claim void ab initio.
The theory is compelling, but the source material is strongest when it moves from theory to application.
Right. These landmark cases are not just examples of legal errors. They are demonstrations of the fraud in operation, where courts act as suitors in their own cause to construct exemptions for themselves and their institutional allies.
We have to begin with the truly disturbing case of Stump v. Sparkman in 1978. This case is foundational to understanding the breadth of judicial immunity. The facts are essential.
Lay them out for us.
A mother told an Indiana judge, Judge Harold Stump, that her 15-year-old daughter Linda was somewhat retarded and promiscuous and requested that she be sterilized. The judge authorized a tubal ligation via a brief administrative order.
An order, not a hearing.
No hearing, no lawyer for the child, nothing. It was then performed on the minor without her knowledge under the guise of an appendectomy. The girl only discovered what happened 2 years later when she married and found she could not conceive.
That is horrific. This was not a lawful adjudicative act. It was an administrative order based on the deception of a parent, authorizing the irreversible destruction of a minor's fundamental right.
Yet the holding granted Judge Stump absolute judicial immunity. The Supreme Court ruled that because Stump was acting in his capacity as a judge, even if the action was taken maliciously or in excess of his authority, absolute immunity applied.
Because the act was declared judicial for immunity purposes.
They stretched the definition of judicial act to cover an action that was fundamentally administrative and destructive. The court ignored the maxim actus non facit reum nisi mens sit rea.
The act does not make one guilty unless the mind is also guilty.
They allowed the judge to separate his intent and the resulting irreversible harm from the consequences of the act simply by labeling it official.
Let's consider Imbler v. Patman next from 1976.
This case extended absolute immunity to a prosecutor, Patman, who knowingly suppressed exculpatory evidence and allegedly used false testimony to frame an innocent man Paul Imbler.
And Imbler spent 10 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. How can the Supreme Court acknowledge such a grave wrong, the framing of an innocent man, and still deny a remedy?
The rationale was purely based on institutional convenience. The court openly acknowledged that this ruling denied the remedy for a violation of a fundamental right, but concluded that accountability must yield to the need for prosecutors to operate without fear of constant harassment.
They explicitly abandoned the central maxim, ubi jus ibi remedium.
Where there is a right, there must be a remedy. In this case, there was a proven right violation, but the court denied the remedy to protect the institution. It's the self-dealing nature of the doctrine on full display.
Moving on to Pearson v. Ray in 1967. This concerned police officers who arrested civil rights ministers under a statute that was later declared unconstitutional. They were enforcing a void law.
The historical rule, ignorantia legis neminem excusit ignorance of the law, excuses no one holds citizens strictly accountable to knowing the law.
But not officials.
Not in Pearson. The court preserved immunity for the officers on the theory of good faith. They ruled that the officers could not be expected to predict the future invalidation of the statute.
So the court inverted the fundamental rule. Ignorance of the law excuses the officials enforcing a void law, but citizens are held strictly accountable to the law that the officials are supposed to know and uphold.
It creates two classes of citizens, one bound by the law and one excused from its consequences.
And most recently, we turn to Trump v. United States from 2024. The Supreme Court declared that a president enjoys absolute immunity for official acts.
Even those involving grave constitutional violations, like attempts to subvert an election.
The difficulty in this case was distinguishing between private acts and official acts.
Mm-hmm. And that difficulty is precisely the mechanism of the fraud. The source identifies the critical flaw. The court's refusal to precisely define what constitutes an official act in the future.
By conferring immunity first, and inviting ambiguity later.
They refused the necessary certainty required to restrain power. They refused the maxim certum est quod certum ready potest. That is certain which can be made certain. The lack of certainty is intentional. It is the mechanism by which they place the executive beyond precise, challengeable judicial reach.
So when you look at the consistent pattern across these cases, judges define their acts as judicial, prosecutors define their misconduct as advocacy, officers claim good faith, executives claim official power.
What you see is the institution violating the core maxim nemo judex in causa sua over and over again. The creature defines the limits of the chains meant to restrain it.
These decisions are not passive legal interpretation. They are active amendments to the Constitution by judicial fiat.
They convert delegated authority into assumed supremacy and ensure that the people may be injured without remedy. It's a closed system where power answers only to itself. And that system, lacking lawful origin, is described by the author as a structural fraud that is void ab initio.
To seal this argument and make it relatable, let's return to the powerful analogy of the employer-agent relationship. This is the most digestible way to summarize the absurdity of immunity.
It really is. The people are the principals, the employers. Government officials are agents, the employees, hired and compensated to perform a specific, limited service.
And in no rational, private system of agency would an employee who steals, abuses his position, or violates trust be allowed to immunize himself from the employer's accountability.
He wouldn't just breach trust. He would be claiming supremacy over the principal. His defense, "I was acting in my official capacity as CEO," would be rejected immediately.
Immunity allows the servant, the employee, to claim supremacy over the master, the sovereign people.
This is a power that is assumed, not delegated, and thus usurpation. If the agent gets to decide whether and how he may be judged for his misconduct, the master has already been displaced.
And the constitutional system has dissolved itself by consent of the agent.
The final synthesis of the source material is that the threat posed by immunity is fundamentally structural. It destroys the constitutional order by reversing the direction of sovereignty, elevating the creature above the creator.
It's a cancer on the system that denies the people their original retained rights of defense and remedy.
The remedy, crucially, is restoration, not rebellion. Restoration of the original constitutional relationship. Restoration to the rule that no office may exempt itself from judgment.
And restoration of the accountability the people never surrendered.
And that leads us to the final, powerful legal punchline. Any act, legislative, executive, or judicial, that grants or enforces immunity shielding officials from the consequences of violating a citizen's fundamental rights is void ab initio.
It lacks lawful origin, violates the trust of delegation, and stands in direct opposition to the common law and the maxims of natural justice.
Immunity falls, not because we need a new law to defeat it, but because the power to grant it was never delegated in the first place.
Here's the provocative final thought based on the material we've explored today. The source argues that the judiciary has successfully dismantled the historical function of the jury, stripping them of the power to judge law as well as fact, and that this act of subjugation is the necessary mechanism by which official immunity flourishes.
Right.
So, given the difficulty of passing a constitutional amendment, what practical steps, short of requiring decades of effort, could the sovereign people take to restore the jury's original power as a final check on official misconduct?
The author concludes by noting, "The chains imposed by usurpation fall away, not because the people seized power, but because they never lost it."
If the right to judge the law remains inherently with the people, the sovereign, then perhaps the restoration lies in the people's refusal to recognize the legitimacy of the judicial instruction that attempts to strip that inherent power. It requires citizens, as jurors, to assert the authority they retain from the beginning.